The following lecture was delivered at the 17th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Palm Desert, California, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Rabbi Moshe Brisky presents his lecture, Do You Believe in Angels?
Sam Goldstein is in the locker room at the health club. He's there with his buddies and the cell phone rings. He picks it up and she gets right into it. Honey, it's me. Are you still at the club? He says, yes. She says, I'm at the mall. I found this beautiful leather coat. It's $450. Can I buy it? He says, if you like it that much, sure, go ahead and buy it. Thanks. I also stopped by the Mercedes dealership. I had a look at some of their leftover 2023 models. I saw one I really, really liked. How much is it? It was $124,000. Well, for that price, take it with all the options. Well, she sees it's going well. She says, one more thing. The house we saw last year, the one that I really, really liked, it's back on the market now. And they're asking $2.5 million. They brought the price down. He says, well, you know what? If you really love it, go ahead and make an offer for $2,480,000. She says, thank you so much, honey. You're an angel. I'll see you later. Thanks. Love you too. Bye. The other men in the locker room, they overheard this conversation and they're looking at Sam in astonishment. An angel indeed. At which point Sam said, anyone know whose cell phone this is? There's a strange episode in the book of Daniel, whereas the prophet Daniel had this very intense vision of an awesome being with a fearsome presence, it says, and a very powerful voice. Daniel says, I saw the vision, but the people who were with me did not see it, and yet still they were overcome with tremendous fear and trepidation. In fact, they were trembling with such fear that they ran into hiding. Story in the book of Daniel. So the obvious question is, if they did not see the vision that Daniel saw, why were they frightened? Why would they run for the hills? And the Talmud asks this question, and the Talmud answers that even though they didn't see it, their representative angel did see it. You see, every person, the Talmud explains, has an angel that represents you in heaven. You have a spiritual counterpart up there. And this is what is meant when you hear about a person's mazel. The mazel is your angel that's watching over you. And this is why if you ever have this certain inexplicable fear or a certain premonition about something, and you don't know why you feel that way, or you have a certain intuition, and it turns out to be well-founded, it may just be that your mazel, your representative angel, saw something that you couldn't see. And it whispers it into your soul so that your soul anticipates it, your soul feels it, your soul knows it's coming, and somehow sends that message to you physically. We're taught in Ethics of Our Fathers, he who fulfills one mitzvah acquires for himself an advocate. That every mitzvah that you do, every word of prayer that you say, every good deed that you perform, you create an angel on your behalf. And those angels, once they're created, are always there for us. Always there to protect us, to advocate for us, to plead our case before the Almighty. These angels stay during our physical lifetime as well as even after our souls returns to our Maker. Our deeds then in our lifetime thus bring about tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of these guardian angels that are there created on our behalf. So what is your concept of an angel? Have you ever seen an angel? If you did the angel have those fluffy white wings? Indeed, the Talmud tells us that Friday night, two angels accompany each person as he or she returns home from the synagogue. And that these angels are there, they're there in the home, and they find the table that's set for Shabbat, and they see the candles and the challah, and they bless the home and all of the inhabitants of the home. And it is in this glow of this blessing that we gather around the table, and how do we start the Friday night dinner? What do? We sing a song. What's the song? Shalom Aleichem. Who are we saying Shalom Aleichem to? Malachei Hashares, the angels that escorted us home, because the angels are there. So we greet them with a song. In our prayers, we make constant reference to angels. The Torah is filled with accounts of the roles angels played in biblical events. Let's go to the first story, Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve encounters an angel who blocks the gate to the Garden of Eden after they were banished from the garden for the sin of eating from the tree of knowledge. We move a little further in the book of Genesis. We have a story of Hagar and Ishmael, then met by an angel in the desert who showed them an oasis of water and saved their lives. Abraham has a famous story of being visited by three angels when he was sitting outside his tent in the heat of the day. Each of those three angels were sent to carry out a very important mission. We spoke yesterday about a story about Jacob wrestling with an angel, how he prevails over this angel, and thus earning the name Yisrael, one who wrestles. Story of Joshua with angels, Isaiah with angels, Ezekiel, Daniel, each saw angels. Even the wicked Bilam in the book of Balak, we have stories about him seeing an angel. So malachim, angels, are very real, and they play a central phenomenon in Judaism. How do they appear in these stories? What do they look like in these stories? Well, sometimes they're completely invisible. They're just there. They're doing their thing. We can't see them. We can't interact with them. And sometimes they show up in a physical human form. Undercover, though. They look like you and me, but they're really angels. They're in disguise. Sometimes in our biblical stories, they disclose their identity, revealing to the players that they are, in fact, divine messengers. And sometimes they never identify themselves. For example, there's a story in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, book of Bereshit, where Joseph goes out to look for his brothers. This is a famous story. It was made into a Broadway play. Apparently, the brothers didn't come home on time. Jacob is worried. So he sends Joseph to find the brothers to the city where he had sent them. And the brothers aren't there. Joseph is about to give up and go home. The Torah tells us, Vayimtzaehu ish. He meets this mysterious stranger. And this stranger tells him, what are you looking for? He says, I'm looking for my brothers. And the stranger says, I overheard them saying that they're going to go on to Dothan. Now, when you read about this encounter with the strangers, it seems rather insignificant. It takes up a verse in the Bible, almost pointless. But think about it. That verse changes the direction of the story. Because the story could have continued, and Joseph came home and told Jacob he couldn't find them. The next verse would have been, and a few hours later, the brothers came home. But instead, this mysterious stranger diverts Joseph not to go home, but to go to Dothan. Now listen closely. If that mysterious stranger did not point Joseph in this direction, he would not have found his brothers, and therefore, they would not have sold him into slavery. Had they not sold him into slavery, he never would have become viceroy over all of Egypt. Had he not become viceroy of Egypt, there never would have been the story of the reunion with his brothers that happened some 20 years later. If he would not have been reunited with his brothers, they never would have gone down to Egypt. If they had not gone down to Egypt, there would not have been an exile. If there had not been an exile, there wouldn't have been a Moses. There wouldn't have been an Exodus. There wouldn't have been a matzah. And most important for many of us, there would not have been matzah balls. All of Jewish identity as we know it, in every aspect of who we are, all starts because one mysterious stranger points Joseph in that direction. Without that, nothing continues the way we know it. How it would have continued, I don't know. What God had in mind for take two, I don't know. But in the story as we have it, this one verse about one mysterious stranger is the link that has the story of Joseph connecting to us and the Jewish people until this very day. One mysterious encounter with a stranger. Who was that stranger? What was his name? I don't know. The Torah doesn't tell us his name. Ish, a person. Was he a human being or was he an angel? I don't know. We're not told in the text of the Torah. The commentaries seem to refer to him as an angel. In fact, perhaps the purpose of this scene in the Torah and this little one-verse diversion in the Torah is to teach us something about random occurrences or chance meeting in our lives. Perhaps they're not chance meetings. They're not random occurrences. Sometimes we meet angels in disguise. Angels who are there to put us in the direction for the rest of the story of our lives to unfold, to guide us, to transform us, to bless us. And we don't necessarily realize it at the time or appreciate it at the time. When we sit back and we reflect about the story of our own lives, perhaps we think about that one turning point, that one moment. Had that one encounter not happened, everything would have been different in our lives. April of 1944, the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, enter the once vibrant city of Munkach to round up all the Jews and place them into ghettos. A month later, they were forced into boxcars en route to Auschwitz. Among those en route for the ill-fated journey was a 17-year-old boy named Shlomo Zalman. It was in the middle of the night, and the train arrives at the most horrible place on earth. And there, hundreds of men, women, and children were herded off the train and told to stand on that infamous line. Shlomo Zalman had no clue as to where he was and why he was there. Nor did he know what the actions of that man standing at the head of the line pointing to the left and to the right as each Jew was brought in front of him. He was too shell-shocked from the harrowing and suffocating journey to know or to care. The smell and the smoke and the shouts and the clubs and the boots and the dogs, it was all too unreal. And as he's waiting on this line, suddenly from out of the darkness, a man, or rather a skeleton of a man, dressed in a striped uniform, emerges and comes towards him. This man grabs Shlomo Zalman by the arms and he whispers him to him in Yiddish, in a heavy Polish accent, asking him, in what year were you born? I was born in 1927, Shlomo Zalman says. You were not, the man says. You were born in 1925. Remember, you were born in 1925. In what year were you born? He answers, 1925. Good. And with that, the man disappeared into the shadows of hell. Disappeared. Never saw him again. The boy came to the front of the line, and he's asked one question. In what year were you born? He says, 1925. He was motioned to the right. It was only later that he would discover that the age of 18 was the cutoff that night between labor and gas chambers. Anyone under the age of 18 was sent immediately to their death. Had he said the year 1927, he would not have been alive. The boy Shlomo Zalman would survive Auschwitz and two other camps. He lived for many decades in Encino, California. He was known throughout the world by the name of Saul Teichman, a businessman, a philanthropist, a father, a grandfather, a great-grandfather. And today there are scores, if not hundreds, of yeshivas and educational centers and synagogues and mikvahs and hospitality centers all throughout the world that bear the Teichman name. He built them, he supported them. And hardly a day went by in Saul Teichman's life that he didn't think about a five-second encounter with a man at the selection line, a man who stepped out from his beyond his own sorrow, beyond his own misery, to save him from certain death. He had never seen this man before, and he never saw him again after. So who was he? Was he a malach? Was he an angel disguised as a human being? Or maybe he was something else. Maybe he was simply a human being disguised as an angel. A human being of flesh and blood playing the role of a divine angel of goodness to save another life. And that's what I want to talk to you about today. The human being who transcends their own selves and comes to us as angels. Elie Wiesel of blessed memory once finished giving a lecture in a certain city, and he was approached by a member of the audience. And she says, "I'm sure you've been asked this question all the time, and I know it's a long shot, but being that in your talk you said you were from Buchenwald during the time period you mentioned, I was wondering if perhaps you would have known or met my father, who was there around the same time." And the woman mentions to Elie Wiesel the name of her father. And tears come to Elie Wiesel's face, and he gets all choked up, and he says, "Do I know your father? Do I remember your father?" Not only were we in the same camp at the same time, we were in the same barracks. I want to tell you something about your father. When I was in Buchenwald, I was at the end. I just wanted it over already. What was there to live for? And like many, I contemplated suicide. The difference between the others and myself was I had gotten hold of some poison. I had within my hands the wherewithal to bring the suffering to an end, and I was determined to do so. And I still remember that day. I came into the bunk to lie down, and my plan was to ingest my magic potion, and that would finally bring me peace. I came into the barrack, and your father was there. You know what he was doing? He was doing what he did every day. He was singing. He had such a beautiful voice, and he loved to sing. And that day, he was singing a song that I remembered from back home, from a different place, from a different world. And even in those horrible barracks, his voice was so piercing. It was so moving. It was so rich. It was so alive, and I challenged him, "How can you sing at a miserable place like this?" And your father turned to me and he said, "Elie, all I have is my song. And my song they cannot take away from me. These animals can take away our limbs of our bodies, but they can't take away our song. They could never take away our song unless we let them." And then he went on singing, and this beautiful voice was talking to me and talking to my soul. In his voice, I heard the sounds of angels. His voice became my resistance, and so I was determined to stay and survive and go on. The human being who comes to us as an angel, they're there for us when we need them most. The year was 1940. Hitler, Yamach Shemai, was tightening his net of evil and madness around Eastern Europe, and Jews were running for their lives. Many ran to Lithuania. At that time, Lithuania was annexed by the Soviet Union, and many thousands came from Poland to seek refuge in Lithuania. But they could see the writing on the wall. They knew it was only a matter of time before Lithuania would become a place of blood and destructions at the hands of the Nazis. But where to run to now? Where to go? No country was opening up their arms to Jewish refugees. One day someone discovered this loophole involving the Dutch and the Soviet councils that would grant the Jews in Lithuania safe passage. But this elaborate plan was contingent upon one thing. The refugees would have to have an official Japanese visa in hand. If Japan was saying they could come to Japan, then the Soviet Union, Russia, would allow them to pass through all of Russia, all of the Soviet Union, from Lithuania to get out on the other end and take a ship to Japan. How do we get a Japanese visa? The Japanese consulate in Lithuania was a one-man operation administered by a very humble, understated individual whose name was Chiun Sugihara. When the notion of issuing Japanese visas to the Jewish refugees was presented to this diplomat, he had a decision to make. He knew that his government would adamantly be opposed to such a thing, to giving Jews visas. And though for him this would mean going against his ministry, this would mean that his career would essentially be over. This would mean that he and his family would be disgraced or indicted or possibly executed. He and his wife looked out the window and they saw these throngs of refugees, men, women, and children waiting outside the consulate. And suddenly they knew there was no choice to be made. In Chiun Sugihara's words, "I may have to disobey my government, but if I don't, I would be disobeying my God." And so from July 31st, 1940, to August 28, 1940, just under 30 days, Chiun Sugihara sat for hours upon hours on hours signing visas. Hour after hour, day after day, he wrote these visas with his hands, knowing that his days at the consulate were numbered. As soon as his government would find out, they would shut him down and bring him back. He wouldn't stop for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. His wife would sit by his side as he wrote and feed him, so that all he would have to do was open his mouth and take the food in and not have to waste any time. He slept a minimum of a few hours a night because every minute meant another life saved. With each passing day, the refugees in front of the consulate would get longer and longer, and Sugihara's writing would intensify. Eventually, the Japanese government got wind of his actions. They ordered his immediately transfer to Berlin. But to the very last minute, he didn't stop writing these visas for life. Even as his train was pulling into the station, there he was, waiting to be escorted onto a train, and he continued to write visas at that very last moment. When he got onto the train, he took his official stamp that he used and he tossed it to a Jew. And he said, "Forge as many as you can and use this stamp. Save as many as you can." After receiving the visas, the refugees lost no time in getting on the train that took them throughout Russia, and most continuing on to Kobe, Japan. They were allowed to stay in Kobe, Japan for several months until Japan got involved in the war, and the refugees needed to move on again, and they moved on to Shanghai, China, where they resided for a number of years until they were able to get visas and permission to come either to this country, to Canada, to Australia. All 6,000 Polish Jews who were issued those visas survived in safety, the second largest number of Jews saved during World War II. In 1945, the Japanese government unceremoniously dismissed Chiun Sugihara from diplomatic service for his defiant and disobedient actions, and he and his children were sent into exile. He had to start his life all over again. He was without a job for over a year. For 2 decades, he was considered persona non grata in his native country, not allowed in. It was only in later years that this man would receive the recognition and the commendation that he deserved. And in 1985, still in his life before his own passing, he was recognized as righteous among the nations by the Yad Vashem Martyrs Remembrance Authority and given the glory and the honor that he deserved for his sacrifice in life. A postscript to this story. During that 30-day period, on August 15th, to be exact, 1940, Chiyun Sugihara issued visa number 1778 to a 17-year-old yeshiva boy who was separated from the rest of the family, his parents, his brothers, his sisters, whom he would never see again. I had the occasion to ask this man what happened back then, and he said, for reasons I don't understand to this day, and these were the words he used, a malach, an angel, was sent from heaven to work in the Japanese diplomatic office in Lithuania to snatch us from the approaching inferno of hate and death. That angel saved our lives. I share this with you because the bearer of visa number 1778 issued on August 15th, 1940, was my father, Rabbi Mordechai Meir HaKohen Brisky of blessed memory, a father, a grandfather, a great-grandfather of hundreds. And it is due to the courage and the compassion of a human being disguised as an angel, Chiyun Sugihara, that I'm able to stand before you today, and that my children and grandchildren grace this earth. I had the good fortune of becoming close friends with Chiyun Sugihara's son, Hiroki Sugihara, who lived in San Francisco at the time that I heard the story. I reached out to him and we visited one another. And Hiroki and I would go travel from Chabad Center to Chabad Center, telling the story of his father, Chiyun Sugihara, and in many locations being welcomed by one of his survivors, one of the Sugihara survivors that lived closest to that city. Hiroki Sugihara, the son, became ill a number of years ago. And the Mira Yeshiva in New York, who many of them were Sugihara survivors, let him be known that all of his medical bills will be covered by the Mira Yeshiva. I met another son of the Sugiharas at Yale University a few years ago when Yale did a program to honor his father's memory. His name was Buki. Buki Sugihara lives in Belgium. And Buki gave me this calculation. I realized how right he is. That if you calculate the 6,000 survivors and you calculate their amount of average children that each one would have, and their children's children, and their grandchildren, and their great-grandchildren. Today on Earth, there would be over 100,000 Sugihara survivors. That's enough to fill Dodger Stadium and Yankee Stadium at the same time from one man, one angel, who decided that he wasn't going to listen to his government, but he was going to listen to his God. So we all need to take a few moments to think about the angels in our lives. Who are the angels in our lives? Because we all have them. Perhaps someone that stepped out from behind the shadow of his own world to rescue you, to heal you, to comfort you, to touch your soul. Perhaps a doctor that you needed at that time, a nurse perhaps who tended to you more than just the regular nursing skills, but really cared about you. Perhaps someone who just happened to say or do exactly the right thing at the right time for you. Who are the angels in your life? Do you stop to think? Those that were there for you when you needed it most. Perhaps it was a teacher that set you on a certain course. Perhaps it was a mother who gave you unconditional love when you perhaps didn't deserve it. Perhaps it was a father whose patience and whose warmth and whose wisdom help you make the right choices in life. Think about the angels that came to you. Human beings disguised as angels. Let's think about the angels in our lives and let's be thankful for the priceless gifts that they have given us and continue to give us each and every single day. But at the same time, my friends, it behooves us to ask ourselves another question. For whom do we serve as angels? Until now, we've been focusing on those that have been angels to us. But what about our responsibility to be an angel to someone else? Or a friend or a neighbor or a relative is in need. Are you there for them? I know we're busy, and I know we all have our own sorrows and our own package of things to deal with. But when someone else is in need, you can be that angel. And sometimes to be that angel is just a phone call. Sometimes it's just a hug. Sometimes it's investing some of yourself. Sometimes it's giving advice. Sometimes it takes hours, sometimes days, sometimes weeks, sometimes months, sometimes years. But God created a world in which there would be angels there for us. There is also that responsibility on our shoulders to be angels for others. And you never know. I've been involved in the people business long enough to know that you really never know just what kind of a difference you could make on the life of another human being. You know, we live in a chaotic world. There's so much about our lives in which we have absolutely no control. But this is something we can control. You could look at any good deed that you have ever performed for someone else and know that you made a real difference. And that will stay with you for the rest of your life. That you affected in a positive way the life of another human being. That's never going away. And do you know how many favors you can do for people when you're part of a community? When you're part of a whole? When you know about others and what they're going through and the struggles that they're going through, so that we can be a part of the solution. There's mitzvahs all around the place in the congregation. On Simchas Torah night in the city of San Diego many years ago, this 9-year-old boy was walking home from the Chabad Shul on Montezuma, that's right across San Diego State University. He and his father had just celebrated Hakafot in the Chabad house. The singing and the dancing with the Torah went on for hours. And now they're walking home on Montezuma Road. And the boy turns to his father and he asks with all sincerity, could we bring the Torah home tomorrow on Simchas Torah? So the father says, no, my dear son, the Torahs stay in shul. We take it out from the ark to read from it. We take it out from the ark to dance with it on Simchas Torah, but nobody takes them home. And the boy began to cry. And the father understood his son's tears. Because the background here was this boy's mother, Chana Sora, who always loved going to Simchas Torah at Chabad, was home ill. And she was battling cancer. And that year, the holidays had not been filled with joy in that house. It was with watching a mother in pain and turning on IV pumps. And so the little boy's question to his dad was, can we bring the Torah home tomorrow so that mommy can have some Simchas Torah too? And when his father said, the Torahs don't leave the shul, his pain just showed in his tears and in his crying. The next day, Simchas Torah, Chana Sora was sitting alone on her recliner in the living room, trying to distract herself from the effects of chemotherapy and the bed sores that she had. She closed her eyes and she was trying to imagine her husband and her two sons in the shul down the street. And she's picturing in her mind her 6-year-old riding on his Abba's shoulders and the 9-year-old dancing gleefully with his friends waving a flag. In her mind, she can actually hear the songs being sung. She can feel the spirit. She was trying to put herself there in the scene. It sounded so vivid, so real, so alive to her. And suddenly she opens her eyes And she sees this was not her imagination. Because outside the front window of her home, there they were. The entire congregation was there. The men in their talisim, the women, the strollers, the children, the Torahs, everything, the entire shul moved from the Chabad house on Montezuma Road to the front of her house. You see, what had happened is this 9-year-old boy's father told Rabbi Fratkin the next morning about this exchange that he had with his son and how painful it was to see his son cry about the health of his mother on Simchas Torah. But I told him, no, we can't take the Torahs out of the shul. And Rabbi Fratkin said, who said? Why not? Why can't we practice Simchas Torah this year instead of in the sanctuary right by your home so that your wife could participate? And so he got up and he said, when it comes to dancing today, we're not going to dance inside this air-conditioned shul. We're going to take our Torahs, we're going to march down the block, and we're going to bring it to their home and we're going to dance there. And here she is, she's watching Simchas Torah happen right in front of her. She sees her husband carrying the Torah. She sees her 6-year-old with this big smile. She sees her 9-year-old son. Mommy, we brought the Torah home for you so that you can kiss the Torah. Everyone made their way into the home to wish her a good yontif, to wish her a refuah shleima. All the Torahs were brought in so that she can kiss it. Angels. Angels. We can be angels. Just a small PS to the story. This 9-year-old boy is a shliach of the Rebbe today in Temecula, California. His name is Rabbi Abrams. I've stayed in touch with Rabbi Abrams, and I just last week attended a groundbreaking ceremony that he had for a new Chabad campus in Temecula and digging of a new mikveh that will be the first mikveh ever in Temecula. His mother, who passed away many years ago from her illness, her neshama lives on with her son. Her memory lives on. There is this unity, there is this simcha, there is this joy that exists within a Jewish community when we can be there for one another. It's this the simcha of compassion. It's the joy that comes along with being compassionate for one another. It's the joy that comes along with a mitzvah. I heard once this Hasidic master put it this way. He said this, on Yom Kippur we describe in our prayers how beautiful the songs of angels are. And it's true that compared to the songs of the angels, the prayers of us mortal man, they're pretty feeble. And we can't compete with the angels singing up above in heaven. As a matter of fact, this Hasidic sage says, there is an angel up above. If those of you good in math, follow me on this. This angel has 1,000 heads. Each head has 1,000 tongues. Each tongue has 1,000 voices. And each voice sings 1,000 melodies. So you can imagine when this angel begins to sing and all the tongues and all the heads and all the voices join in together, it's the greatest symphony that can have ever been existed in the heavenly world. Now when this angel sings, it's quiet because, wow, it's magnificent. And then the rabbi adds this little note. And for all of the beauty, all of the greatness of the symphony of prayers this angel can produce, this angel cannot give a slice of bread to a hungry person. This angel can't help one lonely person. Only you can. Only you, the human being, can do that. So the heavenly angels, they can look out for us, they can protect us, they can direct us, they can advocate for us, they can influence us, but they cannot do the job for us. Hamasehu ha'ikar, action, that belongs to you, to the human being. We have to make it happen in this world. You see, the Torah was not given in heaven to the angels. The Torah was given to us here below. We are the physical human being angels that can actually make a difference in someone's lives by doing something. Back in the summer of 2001, there was a man from New York traveled to Israel on business. For the purpose of this story, I'm going to call him Martin. Between appointments, Martin stopped at a pizza shop hoping to grab a quick bite to eat. He was in a big rush to get to his next meeting, but there was only one person working behind the counter. service is not always the best in Israel. Sometimes it takes a while to get your slice of pizza. And this fellow is taking one order at a time. There's a line of people that's waiting. And he's standing there hungry, and he's fidgeting, and he's impatient. And the fellow in front of him was an elderly gentleman. And the fellow says, "Adoni, you look like you're in a hurry. I'm not. Just go ahead of me." So the fellow says, "I can't do that. You were here first." He says, "No, really. You look like you're in a rush." "I'm not in a rush. I got nothing to do today. Go ahead of me." So he says, "Okay, thank you very much." He goes ahead of him. It's his turn next. He orders his pizza to go. He takes his pizza, and he leaves the store. He thanks the elderly man who gave him the line, place in line, and he leaves. He's back on the street. He walked perhaps a half a block when suddenly he felt this huge shockwave, and his ears rang from a deafening explosion. There was a long moment of silence and then pandemonium. Sirens blaring, people running and screaming. Martin spun around and saw the Sparrow Pizza Shop, the shop that he just came out of, emerging with flames. Yes, it was the famous Sparrow bombing in Jerusalem. Martin had escaped death or serious injury by just a few seconds. He was overcome by this horrible tragedy and the miracle of his rescue, and he just sat there on the ground crying. And then it struck him. The man in front of him who switched places with him must have been in the store. The man who said, "Go ahead of me, I'm not in a rush," was in the store when the bomb went off. "He saved my life. I have to go back. I have to find him." And he hurries back to the scene of the explosion. Of course, everyone there won't let him in. "I have to find an elderly man. He was in line. He was in line. He saved my life." But again, all the workers there are not letting him in. So he waits as each body or stretcher is brought out to see, is this the fellow that helped him? He doesn't find anyone. And so he asks, inquires all the hospitals that people have been taken to. And he goes hospital to hospital to hospital. He has to find him. And he does. And he's alive. He's in bad shape. He's badly wounded, but he's alive. And he goes to his bedside and he holds his hand and he says, "I have to beg forgiveness. That was my place in line. You switched with me. You saved my life. I'm happy you're alive, but what can I do for you? What can I do for you?" And he just stayed by his bedside, holding his hand and crying with him. And then this fellow's son appeared, and he told the son, "This is what happened. Your father did a favor for me. He switched places. This should have been me here in the bed." And after a few days, he recovered to the point that he was able to talk. And he told Martin, "Stop. You don't have to. This was the way God wanted things to be. I'm alive. That's what's important. It's okay. Stop begging for forgiveness." And so he gives the son his business card, and he tells his son, "Listen, if there's anything you'll ever need, anything, just give me a call. There's no way I can repay your father, but just keep this in mind, anything that I can ever do for you." Well, a few weeks later, he gets a call from the son, and the son says, "You know, you gave me your card, you told me to call you, I just want to tell you this. My father needs surgery. A particular surgery that they say the best surgeons in the world for this are in a hospital in Boston. I don't know much about the United States. I don't know much about Boston, but could you help us?" And Martin says, "You got it." Now he's a man on the mission. "Give me the information. Give me the name of the surgeon, the name of the hospital. Get me everything." And this man is, Martin is now not going to stop. He tells the son, "You book the plane tickets. You find out what class, if it has to be first class, get your father a ticket on first class. You're going to go with him, anyone from the family. I'm taking care of everything. It's all on me." He finally felt the guilt removed from his shoulders. There's something that he can do. And indeed, he did. And that day, Martin did something he doesn't ever do. He took off from work. He left New York and he went to Boston to be there for during the time of surgery for his guardian angel that saved him. And that's where he was at 8:30 in the morning, sitting with Yaakov's family in the hospital waiting room at Boston Medical Center. That's where he was on the fateful morning of September the 11th, 2001, when he ordinarily would have been in his office on the 101st story of the World Trade Center. twice. Twice this man was saved from death by of terror. First, a small act of kindness of a man in a line, and then to this huge act of gratitude. The rewards that we do when we do acts of kindness will always come back to us. So let's create angels by being angels. When we give and when we share, we create angels of compassion. When we impart faith, we create angels of strength. When we laugh, we produce angels of laughter. And those angels will always be there for us, to help us and to guide us and to protect us and to advocate for us. You ever wonder this, and I'll conclude with this theme, why at the Passover Seder do we actually get up to open the door to let Elijah in? You know, it's the highlight of the Seder. You put the cup of Elijah in the middle of the table, and then we send someone to the door to open the door to welcome Elijah. If we didn't open the door, you don't think he could get in? Think about it. We believe that Elijah visits every Seder in the entire world, right? And yet, we have to open the door for him. And if not, he can't come through the window? He can't just open the door himself? And yet, we open the door for him. And I think the answer is that if we want to bring the blessings of Elijah's love into our home, if we want to bring the blessings of Elijah, you have to get up and open the door and let him in. If you really want to see angels in your life, you have to open your eyes. You have to take the initiative. You got to do the action. And I conclude with this. There was once a wealthy man who was a follower of the Baal Shem Tov. And this follower, this chassid, had this fascination with Elijah. He just loved all the stories of Elijah. And someone told him that through some certain mystical, secret, spiritual exercises, one can actually get to see Elijah in the physical form. But they keep that secret. They don't tell us regular people. So he goes over to the Baal Shem Tov and he says to the Holy Rebbe Baal Shem Tov, I know you know how to meet Elijah in person. I want the secret. That's all I dream about all my life. I'm an Elijah fanatic. I'm a groupie of Elijah. I need to see him. I will do anything you say. And Baal Shem Tov shrugs him off. I don't got no secret formula. He keeps doing it. Day after day, he's bothering the Baal Shem Tov. I need to see Elijah. I need to see Elijah. And finally, he gets summoned to the Baal Shem Tov, and the Baal Shem Tov says, I'm about to let you in on a secret. However, before I tell you what you need to do, you have to promise me that you will follow my instructions exactly as I give it. And if you do, you will see Elijah. Wow, this is happening. You got it. You say it. He said, Pesach is coming. You're going to inform your family that you will not be home for the first days of Passover. I'm sending you on a mission. You're going to go shopping. You're going to buy all the food that a family could need for Passover. And you're also going to buy clothing, children's clothing, lots of it. Fill up your wagon. I'm sending you to the town of Minsk. And I'm giving you a very particular house that I want you to go to. I want you to wait to Erev Pesach, to literally an hour or two before the Passover Seder is about to begin. And then I want you to knock on the door of this house, and I want you to invite yourself into that home for the first 2 days of Passover. And if you do this, you will see Elijah. Wow! Tells his family, I'm not going to be home, but my dream is coming true. I'm going to see Elijah. Goes shopping, buys everything you can possibly want for a Passover Seder, the brisket, the matzah, the wine, everything, the gefilte fish. He has it all. He packs it up. He buys clothes. He goes to Minsk. He finds the exact house. Remember, he has to wait till right a few hours before Passover Seder to begin. He does it. He knocks on the door. A woman opens the door, sees the man, and the man says, I got stuck in traffic on the freeway here. I'm going to be stuck here in Minsk for Pesach. Could you by any chance have a guest for your Passover Seder? He's following the instructions, as odd as it may sound. The woman says, we would love to have guests for our Passover Seder, but we're quite poor. We don't even have food for ourselves. To which he said, food? Food's not a problem. I got food. And he starts unloading trays and trays and trays. The kids are all dancing for joy. This food for Pesach. The husband of the household, he's so happy. Wow, he's welcomed in as such a guest, brought food with him, matzo, wine. We have everything. And there he is celebrating this Passover Seder, and he knows that when it comes to the part of the Seder that you open the door for Elijah, he knows what's going to happen. Elijah's going to walk in, the real guy, not the invisible angel. He's going to see him. It gets to that point in the Seder, the door is open. He's waiting to embrace. And the same Elijah that visited my house and your house is the same Elijah that came in that day. He doesn't see anything. Maybe Elijah likes the second night Seder better. He waits for the second night. Same thing happens. He's dumbfounded. He can't understand. 2 days are over. He goes back to the Baal Shem Tov. I did everything you said. I followed every instruction. I didn't see him. You didn't see him? Didn't see him. Something must be wrong. Let's do it again. Second days of Passover. Tell your family you won't be with them. You're going to go back to the same house. You're going to buy more food. You're going to buy more clothes. You're going to buy toys for the kids. You're going to buy everything that you could possibly think of that this family could use. You're going to travel there. You're going to, again, wait until before Yontif. But this time, one change. Before you knock on the door, eavesdrop. Listen to the discussion. You follow these instructions, you're going to see Elijah. He follows the instructions. He buys everything he needs to buy. He packs it all up in his wagon. His family says goodbye to him, but don't worry, I'm going to see Elijah this time, the Baal Shem Tov promised me. And he makes his way to the town. He waits there, and he remembers the instruction, but this time, don't knock on the door right away. Eavesdrop a little bit. And he listens, and he hears the following. The children are crying. Mommy, mommy, we're hungry. We haven't eaten the whole day. To which he hears the mother responding, children, children, do you remember when you were crying a few days ago before the Pesach Seder started that you had no food and you had no clothes? And what did I tell you, children? I told you that God would send Elijah to bring us food and clothing and everything else that you need. And wasn't I right? Didn't Elijah come into our home an hour before Passover and brought us food and brought us clothing? Certainly Elijah's about to come again and be with us for Yontif. The chassid standing outside this door understood the Baal Shem Tov, and he knocked on the door. Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to see angels in your life, be an angel to someone else. It's one thing to want to see Elijah. It's more important to be Elijah. Thank you very much.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.